Taking a look at home renovation and repair next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison, Design Build, and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg, our guests once again. They're regulars. They come by every couple months to talk with us. And certainly, if you have some questions for them as we move along, you can join in, too, with a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. If you want to post something on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, that will work, too. John, good to have you back.
Glad to be here, Larry.
And Ken, great to see you again. Well, we see each other reasonably often.
It's good to see you, too, and John. Ken's and talk to your listeners.
Ken's doing a small amount of work on the house that we're moving into. September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April. It's been kept you busy for about 8 months.
Yeah, pretty much.
But we'll be moving in a week or this weekend, and so we're looking forward to that. And so my questions mostly get answered almost right away. What about yours? Again, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And, John, you're busy, I imagine, as
always. We are very busy, Larry.
Yeah.
Well, we're 7 days a week busy.
Oh, that's too busy. No?
Well, yes, no. That is indeed too busy, but there are lots and lots and lots of problems out there with home sales right now. Mm. And we get called in sometimes where there are significant issues with properties. And, of course, now we have properties that have been off the market in foreclosure for up to 2 years. And the kind of disasters you can have when you have a vacant place is pretty amazing. And I think we're going to have a question on that, too, aren't we? What to do if you're leaving a place vacant.
Yeah, actually, and that maybe that's a good thing to take up right off the bat.
Probably is.
What about it? What should we do? You know, what should happen if you're if you're going to be vacating a place, and as a matter of fact, we will be moving from one house to another, and it'll be about a month before the people who are renting the new our other home move in. So that's only a month as compared to 2 years. But
well, the problems, of course, foreclosed houses are a whole different thing. We won't discuss that. But we do have people, senior citizens who are fortunate enough to have a condo in Florida and they leave for 6 months, or people have a great place up near Tomahawk, but they only get up there maybe once during the winter, and so they close the place down. And one of the issues we've been seeing is mold in houses, is the temperature drops. Even in Madison, people set the heat at 55 because they're not going to be there, and they come back, and the basement has turned green on them simply because they've gotten that they've gotten the humidity level. The relative humidity, of course, is going to increase as the temperature decreases. So you can end up with that sort of issue. On a cottage, it may be better to have the heat off entirely to dry it out rather than just to put it low, which means you've got to have a winterized system. Ken, you can probably talk about winterized systems in cottages a little bit. What to do with the water is the big issue, isn't it?
Well, if you're going to be leaving a cottage through the winter, what you want to do is you want to shut off the water to the cottage, make sure the branch outlets are have no water in them, and if you could drain the system out, do that. A lot of times at either at the well storage tank or at the if you have city water, you can at the shutoff there's a little petcock you can turn and drain the water out of the house, and that's a pretty important thing to do, I think.
We actually have Mike in Crandon who has a question that relates right to that. So let's Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Actually, you kind of answered it, the cottage up north thing. You know, typically we turn the temperature down to, you know, like 50 just to keep it warm. We do drain the water just in case the heat does go out. But, you know, is there something more that we should be doing, or should we be keeping that temperature higher? That's kind of one question. Then I have an ice damming question. So,
oh, what's your ice damming question?
Well, the facility has a I guess a cathedral ceiling, so that there's no attic area. If you can visualize what I'm saying.
Sure.
And I'm getting ready to probably put a new roof on. And I noticed that this winter I had an ice damming, and we just got the place last year. And what has happened, or where I noticed it, is right where there's recessed lighting, wherever there were two roof joists, that seems to be where the snow melted off and the ice damming occurred. Mm-hmm. So my question is obviously there's not either there's no insulation or there's insulation and too much insulation and not enough ventilation. And am I on the right track with that? And how do I best go about figuring out what's the problem without literally cutting the roof deck off?
Well, that's a good question. Mike, that's a very good question. How thick are your roof joists above your cathedral ceiling? Is it a truss ceiling or is it?
It's probably like it's a 1978 home, so it's I think they're like 2x10s, 12s, whatever.
Okay. The reason I ask is when you have a ceiling fan, of course, or a recessed can, you have no insulation around it, so that creates a hot spot in the roof, and you're right on the money. That is an issue. There are some can lights that you can insulate around, or you can put a cage around and then blow foam or insulation around. If you're going to tear off the roof, that might be something you can look at now. But I'm going to back up a little further. You're up in Crandon, so
I'm in Crandon, but the home is further north. It's on the Wisconsin-Michigan border.
Oh, it's lovely up there. Well, anyway, one thing you could do would be to, when you tear off the roof, is to re-insulate that cavity. That you basically have to take the sheathing off.
And that's kind of what I'm asking is I don't have to tear it off. I'm asking, is that the only way I'm going to be able to fix this?
Well, is it a wood ceiling?
It's a tongue and groove wood ceiling, and then it's a wood deck and shingle roof.
So that's really you want to basically do it from the top because it's going to be a lot less expensive, and since you have to re-roof it, this is just an extra step. Another possibility is that you could add insulation to the top of the roof. There's several products out there, but one of them that's made in the state in Wisconsin is Thermacell? Is that what it's called?
Cornell panels from the Cornell Corporation are made here in the state.
Yeah, I think their product is called Thermacell or something like that. But it's basically foam insulation like a polyisocyanurite with an air gap above it, and then a plywood or a wafer board on top, and you can strip your shingles off and lay this right on top of the roof plane, and then you've got added insulation, and you can get this stuff 2-inch insulation up to, I think, maybe 8 inches of insulation. It's pretty significant. There's some issues with that. You have to redo your fascia, and there's the ventilation at the bottom. You have a ventilated metal edging that you put on so that air can work its way above the insulation. So that'd be another possibility for you. You might want to do is start with an energy audit. You know, John and I are always hawking these things because they're so valuable. And one of the things they'll do is put the house under negative pressure and walk around with an IR camera, and they'll tell you right where your trouble spots are pretty regularly, and they'll also give you a list of many other things you can do to make that building more energy efficient.
Yeah, for a couple $100.
Yeah, it's really, and you get, if you do achieve a certain level of energy efficiency, you get some money back, either in the form of rebates or tax credits.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry in Middleton, we are on to you now. Hi, Larry.
Thank you. I have a question about ice and water shields on roofs. Due to a recent hailstorm, I'll be replacing my 8-year-old roof. My roof now has an underlayment of Elk self-adhering waterproofing membrane, and I want to continue to have the full protection from that particular type of membrane. And my question is, given that my present membrane has nail holes in it or might be damaged when they remove the old shingles, would it be best to replace the present membrane or put a new layer over the existing layer?
Yeah. Well, yeah, what do you think, John?
You're correct, Larry. You do have nail holes, so that membrane is not going to perform very well. I think you can go over it with an additional membrane, assuming that it is going to stick, and you're probably going to have to look up which, if it is an elk membrane, to see whether you can go over the top of it. You can go right to the elk website and email their technical support and ask them that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess that takes care of it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Good luck, Larry. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, a caller who does cottage maintenance work wanted to mention on this relating to cottages that people don't think about the fact that when they turn off the cottage electricity to save money, the sump pump doesn't work.
It sounds like he knows that from experience.
He can speak from experience, apparently, on that one. So and a lot of cottages, you know, aren't in a situation where they need a sump pump. But if you got one.
Well, with all our beautiful lakes and the cottages close to the lakes, yeah, that's something to pay attention to.
Maya and Lindale, let's turn to you now. Hi, Maya.
Hello. I have a sort of an unusual problem. We have a beautiful fireplace in the basement, and so we decided to pull off this false wall we had because we thought we would discover a beautiful fireplace in the living room. Unfortunately, we have a rather sad-looking fireplace in the living room of field stone, but the problem we have is there are two vents on the top of it and two vents on the side.
Mm-hmm.
We've had four masons come in. Two never came back. One man, he seemed quite knowledgeable, said, "I've never seen anything like it. We really would have to kind of tear it down."
Oh, no.
And so my husband and I have been having perpetual discussions. We are now sitting with this fireplace, and we don't know what to do. So I was wondering if your company ever comes out this far. I live there in Milwaukee. Or if you have any suggestions or anything. We just don't know what to do.
Well, we don't come out that far.
Okay.
I'm Ken from Adams Construction. We work in the Dane County area. But what I've seen before on fireplaces, especially ones built in the late 60s and 70s, is they would make a masonry fireplace and they'd have a vent below that would sort of let air from the house into it, and then
right.
The air would heat up as it moved up around the firebox and come out the top. And
right.
That's probably what you have there.
Right, that's what my husband thinks.
Yeah, and so if you were talking to a mason, I'm surprised the mason wouldn't have been able to pick that out for you. Are you able to take the vents out and look inside?
That's what we did. My husband pulled out, and the interesting thing is there was the insulation stuffed in there. Which was kind of unusual.
Oh, that's not good. No.
So my husband pulled that out.
Good.
And then you can just see there's that empty space. But the big question seemed to be this one gentleman who seemed quite knowledgeable. He said he'd never seen anything like it. Like I said, the weather just never got back to us. So we were in the process of ordering a mantle because, see, once we tore off the wall, whoever put up the wall just put the wall right up to the ceiling, and so when we took off the wall, we have this. Now we have this fireplace with no top on it.
Yeah.
And it's really so sad because the basement one is a beautiful fireplace. It's marvelous. And why they did this in the living room is beyond us. But you know,
when was your house built?
Somewhere probably in the 50s.
Oh, in the 50s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because quite often you could, if you really like the idea of having a fireplace up there, you could change the facade. The fireplace probably isn't just a stone fireplace. It's probably a cement block with a stone facade.
Oh.
And that would be evidenced by those vents. So,
when you look inside, that's interesting. Now, it looks like there's stone inside. Well, I can't really tell.
Okay. Well, what I would suggest is getting a couple of other masons out there and see if you could find some old guys that have been around for a long time and they usually have run into this before, so that's where I would start. If you don't get a satisfactory answer from, from one, just keep going and just you'll see a theme. You'll see a theme after a while. Do you want to add anything, John?
Well, there's a couple of types of these old fireplaces.
Mm-hmm.
If they have steel fireboxes, that's the most usual type.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were just convection. Others had fans built in. Others actually have round tubes over the top of the fireplace opening inside where you would expect the damper to be. and those also were used to transfer heat. I think your suggestion about rebuilding is a good idea, because if this is a 1950s fireplace, it doesn't have outside combustion air coming into it. If it is a steel firebox, those were meant to be cooled, so if you stop cooling them, they have a tendency to warp. If it's an old masonry firebox, it's probably getting up there in age. And I think you're probably correct. The general structure, the flue, the concrete masonry units are probably all fine. And one could probably reskin this, put in outside air, and have a much more efficient fireplace than they currently have.
So in other words, when we were trying to save some money, the idea of just putting a mantle on top would not be a good idea, is that it?
No, you really need to have a knowledgeable person look at this, because there is the possibility of overheating these fireplaces, which is why Ken was saying he was glad you took the insulation out. These fireplaces are meant to be cooled by airflow. So I'm surprised you haven't been able to find a mason in Milwaukee that understands this, because
There's plenty of masons.
I've seen hundreds of these, and I'm sure Ken has as well. So just call and ask if people give them a good description, maybe even shoot a picture of it so you can email them, tell them whether it's a steel firebox or a masonry firebox. And just by talking to them on the phone, you'll find somebody it's worth inviting out.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates, Fitchburg. Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison, our guests. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have lots of callers online and lots of emails here to deal with. An email from Gary, who says, what do you use to put between the roof and trusses that will be next to a brick wall to seal the new garage roof being changed from a flat roof, one of the end truss from the new garage roof? Are you following that?
I'm not completely clear, but it sounds to me like he's changed a flat roof to a pitched roof next to a chimney, and he wants to know what to do. If that sounds right, does that sound like...
Next to the brick wall to seal the new garage roof from a flat roof. He's trying to seal a new garage roof from a flat roof.
Okay. I'm not sure what he means.
I probably shouldn't have brought that one up, as we probably need more information.
Send there. That email again and rephrase it. Maybe we'll understand it. Sorry about that.
Let's go to Dennis in Toma next. Dennis, hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question concerns a tri-level that we live in, of which the third level has a cement basement. We would like to put in a wood floor, and the question is, should there be a vapor barrier between a concrete and the bottom of the wood floor?
All right, John Freiberger,
Yes, Dennis, I can tell you exactly what I would prescribe for you if I drove all the way up there to Toma. The first thing is I put down a 6-mil polyethylene vapor diffusion retarder over the concrete wall. I'd run that up along the sidewall and seal it a little bit. I then would probably go ahead and put in some rigid insulation above the slab. At least an inch or so that's going to be warm. Put sleepers on top of that insulation, and if you use an isosandrite insulation, that's going to support.
What's a sleeper, Jen?
I was just about to ask that.
Ken, I would have thought you would have known that after all these years. Basically, a sleeper is going to be most likely a 2x4 that you're going to be able to nail your wood floor into, and it's laying there all covered up. Therefore, it's like you much of the time, a sleeper. That is going to give you a dry environment, a warm environment, and good adhesion then for your wood floor.
There you go. Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate your call. We have Irene and Phillips next. Let's go there. Hi, Irene.
Yes. Hi, fellas.
Hi.
We're up here in Price County, and a few months ago I got something in the mail from XL Energy, $45 energy assessment. And I took it and read it, and by golly, we signed up for it, and it's a special deal in four counties, Buffalo, Price, Sawyer, and Trempealeau, for the entire year. And it the fellow came out last week, spent 3 hours here, and sent us a report, which I've passed on to our contractor who's going to put on siding and windows. And I just know this is going to save us hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year in energy.
Oh, that's terrific. Is Xcel Energy, is it related to an energy, focus on energy?
Yes,
or
they're
energy
working in partnership with Focus on Energy. And then there are some incentives here for things that we will be doing. And I'd like to give the contact number at Focus on Energy, if I may.
Sure, go right ahead.
Sure, it's 800-762-7077. It's the best $45 I think we've spent this year.
That's a great price, and what a good service you're doing for your house and your pocketbook and the environment.
Irene, repeat those four counties again so our listeners can catch that in case they're in there.
Sure. Buffalo, Price, Sawyer, and Trempealeau for the year 2012, through 2012. No, ours, I think, expires on 2011.
Okay.
December 31st. So it's a great deal. It's worth $350 is what they would ordinarily charge, but this is a great plan. I'd like to share it with others.
Well,
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate that very much. Yeah.
Great deal.
Focus on Energy is a great, great service. We have an email from Alicia in Dodgeville. We purchased our home about a year and a half ago. The windows in our home are fairly new, but the previous owner told us she had replaced the upstairs bathroom window due to mold between the panes. Now, after this winter, I've noticed that three more windows have mold between the panes as well. One downstairs, two upstairs. What are the best options for resolving, preventing this problem?
If she's got... My guess is that when she says mold between the panes, she's talking about mold between the inside window and the storm window, which is, I've seen that before because you have a leaky window, so you get a lot of moisture, condensation and moisture build up in that area, and then you get some mold. If she's talking about, Alicia, if you're talking about mold between the two panes of a thermal pane window, so you've got two pieces of glass in one sash in one window. It's probably not mold. It's probably a broken seal, in which case you could replace that, have that sash replaced. If they're not very old, you might be able to get them done through warranty with the manufacturer of the window. Otherwise, you'd want to get a reputable window company out there and measure it up and see if they can get you an exact match. With regard to the if it's between the window and the storm window, you want to find a way to make that window more energy efficient. And if it's an old single pane glass, it's an uphill battle, wouldn't you say, John? And
well, not necessarily. I often tell people if they've got these old windows to really think about weather stripping and reduce the amount of flow of air that's getting out and carrying that moisture. But if you look at how old windows perform when they're weather stripped and taken care of versus how new windows perform, sometimes there's only a 20% difference.
Depends on the windows, yeah.
It depends upon the window, yes. There's some old windows that are really good, and there's some new windows that are really junk.
There you go.
You heard it from John.
Thanks, Alicia. Kathy in Elk Mound, we turn to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is, we have a shingle roof, and we're wanting to put a metal roof over the shingles, and we're questioning what is the best technique. We've heard some people say that you put a kind of a foam layer and then put the metal right over the foam layer, and then we've heard other people, no, because that'll make so you don't have any kind of ventilation going through there, so you need to put strips across there. So that's one question. Second question is, when we look at metal, what kinds of things should we be looking at in terms of general quality or questions we should be asking about different metal roofs? And could I take my answer off the phone so that my husband can hear on the radio?
Yeah, I think we can do that.
Well, there's lots of options in metal roofs, Kathy, including now there are several companies making metal shingles. And these metal shingles, some of them interlock, and they can be put on by any roofer, and they are much less expensive than the standing seam roofs. Then there's the plain old exposed fastener roofs, too, which I certainly wouldn't want to put on a house. The sort we see on ag buildings, though. I just saw one last week where they had done it, because fastener failure is a real problem with metal roofs. So if you're going to a metal roof that is put in long strips, you want to make sure that you have hidden fasteners with standing seams, and that it needs to be good quality, and you need to check on things like the warranty of the finish. Your house roof also has to be relatively straight. If you're in an old house and there's a little bit of sag in the ridge and the rafters are only 2x4s, it might be real hard to get that that standing seam metal roof to work well. And then the metal shingles, in that case, may be a little bit of a better choice for you. You do want to maintain ventilation so that your attic does not overheat. So you do want your airspace underneath the original sheathing. Some metal roofs now are coming with basically the entire roof is covered with almost like an ice and water shield or 45-pound felt, so that you've got a secondary barrier to moisture underneath the roof. And so there are various manufacturers. You're going to have to take a look and go to their websites, download the specifications, look at the warranties careful, and then start doing some cost-benefit analysis and see what you're getting for the money. Also, really check the credentials of the person who is installing this for you, because there are roofers out there that really don't have a clue. And I would say when you get to metal roofs, you're down to maybe only 5% of the roofers in business really know how to put them on.
There you go. So be a little careful. Kathleen in West Allis, we're on to you. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. In my next life, I'm coming back as a roofer, because you're right. It's a real expertise. But I have a porch on the second floor of my house, and I use it a lot. It's a sitting room, plant room kind of thing. And I discovered a leak in my kitchen, and I know that there's some flaws in the rubber roofing material that's on that flooring.
Mm-hmm.
And the roofer that I had come out here gave me a nice estimate on repairing it and so forth. But then he offered me another option. He said, maybe I should consider a metal, like a copper. And I'm wondering what your recommendation is on this. Because I walk out there a lot. It gets a lot of use.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a flat...
What's on the roof now? Do you...
It's a rubber.
So you're walking right on the rubber?
Yes.
Oh, that's I hate to say it, but that's their first mistake. The rubber roofs are very, very stout, but they're not really made to be walked on. They're not made to put furniture on.
Okay.
You could put a deck on top of that, and there's a product that John turned me on 2 years ago, and we use it now very, very often. It's called PlayGuard.
Okay.
You can look this up online, and you just type in PlayGuard, and it'll take you right to the website, PlayGuard.
Okay.
You're probably throwing a lot of money away if you go to a copper roof underneath this, and it's going to be a soft roof anyway. You really don't want to be walking on copper, so...
Well, that's my question, yeah.
Yeah, and copper is pretty expensive right now. It's at almost all-time highs, I think. So you probably would be better off repairing or if you can, replace that rubber roof. How old is that rubber roof?
1 year.
Oh.
Yeah, it's only a year. It was not put on correctly.
And why? How do you know that?
Well, I've had several 5 or 6 roofers out here, all of which have told me that the application was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't seal the little lip along the wall.
Oh, okay.
And so water is seeping in, and the flashing wasn't done correctly. The company that did the work is out of business. So
that's not surprising. Mm-hmm. Roofers, there's some very, very good roofers out there, but it's also one of those businesses that if you have a ladder and a hammer, you can call yourself a roofer. And so you really want to be careful. You want to make sure you check references. I would say start there. I would say... I know you put money out for this thing. If you have no recourse, I would have it either repaired or completely replaced.
Okay.
And then look for a surface that you could put on top, like this PlayGuard. There are other options out there. And if you don't like this, I think you will. But if you don't like this, we can talk about that later. Feel free to either email John or I, and we'll be able to talk to you. So good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for calling. And John and Eau Claire, we are on to you now. Hi, John.
Morning. Hey, I'm finishing my basement, and I've had two contractors tell me not to put up a vapor barrier, and two contractors who told me to put up a vapor barrier. So I'm just wondering, should I put one up or not?
John, why don't you break the tie?
Okay, well, if you're finishing a floor, on the floor, definitely. On the walls, it depends. In many cases, I think it's probably better not to have a vapor barrier on the wall because because you've got a lot of surface there. Some of it fairly, generally the higher in the wall, unless you've got a lot of groundwater, generally the higher the wall, often you'll find more moisture coming through the wall, and it is good to diffuse that into the basement. What I would be very careful of without a vapor barrier on the wall is to make sure that all of the materials that you use are fungal resistant. Now, there are fungal resistant drywalls out there, and those are going to help you a bit. But you really need to understand that your basement walls have not leaked in the past, your basement is not particularly damp, and if that's the case, then you can be fairly sure that what you put up will work without a vapor barrier. We actually use some systems in very damp basements where we use a treated wood sill plate, metal studs, and we use an exterior grade of calcium sulfite board like a Gold Bond board, and we thin coat plaster over it. So basically, there's no paper material in there at all. And the only cellulose we have is that lower treated plate. And I think you could spray a fire hose on these wall systems and they wouldn't get moldy. So know your walls. How old is your house, John?
10 months.
Oh, 10 months. Okay, so fairly new. Also, a 10-month-old house, your house is still exhaling moisture from the original construction.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, how long do you suggest people really wait to let things dry before you...
Foundations pump out water for probably at least a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if you're going to seal up that basement, I would wait at least till next spring.
Yeah, I'm with you. 18 months to 2 years is what I've usually thought because there's a lot of moisture coming out of the concrete. The other thing that may happen to you, John, is as that concrete does cure out, you may develop some small cracks.
Okay.
And those may need to be treated because concrete, of course, is going to shrink as it loses the water because part of its size depended upon the water that was in there.
Did you have the house built, John? John. Did you have the house built? Did they do a waterproofing system on the exterior of the foundation?
Yeah, it's more like I've seen the black stuff, but they use like more of a white coating on it.
Was it a coating or was it a sheath or
I'm not sure.
Sprayed on?
It was
sprayed on.
Sprayed on?
Yeah, okay, good. So you've probably got a good damp and waterproofing out there, and the little curing cracks are going to not damage that. So I think the big key here, since you've invested in the waterproofing, is to forget the vapor barrier on the wall, but do let this basement cure out a little bit before you get going on it.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. We have Donna emailing, I painted epoxy on the new garage floor, and within 2 years it began to chip away. Anything I can do for that? The garage floor, so cement.
Well, we don't have enough information, Larry. Donna's going to have to tell us how old this garage floor is. I guess we can say generally that...
She said a new garage floor.
New garage floor.
Well, that's probably pushing it. The moisture's probably pushing it off.
Yeah, see reply to John. I think what you did there, Donna, is you put a vapor barrier over concrete that is trying to breathe out. And so what it's doing is it's probably causing little blisters and pops in the epoxy. Should have probably waited at least a year to coat that floor.
It's like painting wet wood. It'll eventually just push the paint right off, and that's what's happening here.
Robert in Rice Lake. Hi, Robert.
Hi. good morning.
Morning.
I have a question on... I have a house that's a story and a half, and I have a upstairs room, and I insulated that, and now I have another insulator that came along, and I was talking to him about some more, and he's talking about wanting to dense pack the between my ceiling and my roof. And I was wondering, I was always under the impression that you could leave an airspace in there. My question is whether or not that should be dense packed or whether it should have an airspace between the ceiling and the roof of that part.
Generally, Robert, if you call technical support at GAF, one of the largest shingle makers, and ask them that question, they will say, well, you can dense pack it, but if your shingles fail, we're going to come out and tell you your roof overheated and you're not going to have a warranty. So that's what I usually suggest to people, is to somehow preserve an airspace. How thick are the rafters that they're looking at dense packing, Robert?
Well, the rafters on the on that is only 2x4s on my roof, and then I've got about an 8-inch airspace, and then I've got 8 inches of insulation between that and the ceiling, and it seems to be working now. We used to have an icing problem, but that's gone since I've changed it over like that.
Okay, so you've got 8 inches of dense pack in there right now, so you're basically in the R25 range, which for Rice Lake is about half of what you want up there. If you're building that house new, I believe the minimum would be 44 in Rice Lake, wouldn't it, Ken?
More than that, no.
More than that, might even be 50.
Yeah.
So I think you do want to add more insulation there, but you do want to get chutes in along the edges and maintain some airspace.
So you're thinking like you'd want to leave a air gap maybe on the ends or something?
Yes. Well, I'm hoping, Robert, that you've got soffit vents on the outside to allow air to come into that little attic that you have.
We do have soffits, but I don't know if they're actually all vented.
Okay, they really should be vented. Tell you, I'm going to send you to a website. Grab a pen there, quick.
Okay.
This is a real nice website because it gives you cross-sectional drawings. It really explains things. It gives you worksheets you can download for insulation venting. And it's coravent.com, and it's C-O-R, and then a dash, the letter A, another dash, V-E-N-T.com. Great consumer-friendly website. Ken and I both use their products on historic houses because they make things for hard-to-vent houses. But they'll give you a really good explanation of the interface between heat buildup, moisture, and how high and low venting works.
If I can understand it, anyone can.
There we go.
There is a great recommendation.
Core-A-Vent.
Coreavent.com. Right.
All right. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Certainly, yeah. Robert.
And Julia in Mount Horeb. On to you now. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a house that was built in 1928, and the previous owners did a lot of work. They were a young couple, and I don't know if they did everything right, but what I did discover in the attic of the walk-up attic is that they insulated the rafters real heavily, and then they covered it with a plastic wrap, and then the floorboards, which are tongue and grooved, were pulled up and insulated, but I discovered that that insulation was installed upside down. Now, I have a lot of problems, and I realize old houses crack and stuff, but last fall I hired someone to come in to repair all of my cracked ceilings, and he's a good professional and did a great job. But now they're all reappearing again. And I'm wondering, is my house too... Is it like a moisture barrier in my attic because that insulation was installed upside down?
Well, what do you think, John?
I think in a 1928 house, Julia, your house is probably about as leaky as mine is.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that the winter humidity levels or relative humidity in your house is probably 40% or under. Is that?
I have radiator heat.
Yeah. But your house, you don't get ton of condensation on the windows, do you, in cold weather?
No.
Okay. So you have a fairly dry house. I think the cracking in your house is due to structural reasons.
Okay.
Now, structural reasons, if this is a balloon-framed house, and if they insulated the walls and did not put a vapor barrier on the inside walls, that can be the structural issue. Because
okay.
We could actually have deterioration of the fasteners and of the wood sheathing, that makes that house structurally sound. So mm-hmm. I think you're going to have to do a little bit more investigation, figure out exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, it is extremely important that old houses, when the walls are insulated, that a vapor barrier be applied to the inside or you get condensation inside the wall. In fact, mm-hmm. the Department of Interior in the guidebook for historic restoration does not allow us to insulate older houses unless we can provide a vapor barrier on the interior. So you may want to check out and see what's happening there. It sounds like It sounds like an energy audit would probably be helpful in the winter. If there's a lot of moisture coming into the walls, that is going to show up as areas of more rapid transfer.
Okay.
You may have to do a bit of digging around to see exactly what they did.
Okay, can I ask you one more question about that then? The siding on the house is cedar shake, and that's the original. And 4 years ago, I had it painted by a professional, and all of the paint is just about off.
That sounds a lot like we've got significant moisture migration going through the walls. And if that is the case, we could actually have structural issues due to condensation inside the walls. So you're going to have to probably seek some expert advice on this.
And who would you suggest I?
Well, why don't you email me?
Yeah, you're in Mount Horeb.
Yeah, you're close to Madison, so email me at FREI.
FREI.
At chorus.net. And chorus is like a group of singers, CHORUS.
At chorus.net.
Yeah, and we can chat about it a little bit.
Okay, well, thank you so very much.
Certainly.
I really appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Ken Adams and John Freiberger, our guests, as we talk home renovation and repair. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in our conversation today with Ken Adams and John Freiberger by calling us at 1-800-642-1234 or shoot us an email, talk@wpr.org. That'd be fine. Or even go to the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Rick in South Range, waiting a little while. Rick, hi. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, no, my pleasure waiting. My wife and I put in a concrete patio on the south side of our house probably 30 years ago, and it's cracked and heaving, and she wants that great big slab to be gone and turn it into some more gardens. But I guess I don't know where to start getting rid of a big piece of concrete. It's probably 25 feet long and 20 feet deep, probably 4 inches thick. Do you just break it with a sledgehammer?
The real ticket would be to get somebody else to break it with a sledgehammer. There's a couple things you can do. If you have access to the backyard, you could hire someone to bring a little bobcat in, and they could break it up with they'll have an attachment they could break it up with, and then they'll just carry it out in their buckets. If you don't have that access, you could rent an electric jackhammer, like a 90-pound jackhammer, for a couple hundred bucks for a few days, and chop it all up, and then hand carry it out. It's not a small task.
No, it probably wouldn't be, and it'd probably be a good job for the neighbor kid.
There you go. Make sure you have plenty of food around and loud music, and it'll be fine.
I do have a friend with a backhoe, and he came in and pulled out a basketball pole last summer, but he left me ruts probably halfway from between here and Rice Lake.
That's the other side of it. Did he have a track or did he have wheels?
Wheels.
Well, wheels usually will leave less of a mark than tracks, but you'd have to work your way back out. A small bobcat with wheels would probably be a little bit easier on the surface. But like I say, manual labor too, is the ticket. There's another issue too. Since this thing lasted as long as it did, it's probably got a very good base underneath it. It might be gravel or sand. If it's sand, that would be great. But if it's gravel, you might have to dig that out to get your topsoil in there. So
something else to think about.
So
I got you. Well, yeah. Thanks for the advice.
Yep. Good luck,
Gordy in La Crosse. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My parents built a home in 1973, and it's cinder block walls. And I was college age in those days and helped with a bit of the building, so I was around it quite a bit as the house went up. Probably, 20 years after they had lived in the house, the top two or three courses of block all the way around the house that has basement attached to it or basement underneath it has started to deteriorate. The block is kind of cracked and fallen away. The area around the garage, which doesn't have a basement under it, obviously, and is not heated, those blocks look perfect. Inside of the house, things look really pretty good. some of it's paneled, so I can't see all of it. But the deterioration really seems kind of confined to those top two or three layers of block on the outside of the house, really all the way around it.
Hmm.
And they put a skim coat of concrete on it a few years ago,
hide it.
And that lasted for a little while, and then they tried some epoxy kind of finish. That's
put Band-Aid on it.
A Band-Aid that's going to fall off quickly.
It
sounds like, now, if it's the top rows, generally, if you go into a house, the warmest part of the house, of course, is going to be at the ceiling because hotter air goes up, and, of course, hotter air carries more moisture. Now, built in 1973, this house probably has no vapor retarder. So what's happening is the moisture is going out. It's going into these blocks, which are quite porous, and then it's freezing and it's spalling the block away.
Okay.
So the solution here may be pretty simple, and that is to paint the walls with walls and ceiling, on the, at least the exterior walls, with a vapor barrier paint. And there are HUD-certified paints. Glidden makes one, I believe, that's called Insulade. Ken, who else? Sherwin-Williams make one?
All the major manufacturers have them, but they have to be for masonry application.
No, but we're talking about doing the inside walls, which I think are plaster, aren't they?
Actually, the inside walls of the basement are pretty much still just block.
It is just block.
And we've paneled, it's probably two-thirds of the basement walls have paneling on them. So.
Yeah, well, then Ken is right. We're going to have to find something that will adhere to the CMU, though I think that Insulate as a fairly heavy acrylic latex will. But I think that interior would probably help. The other product to check on, and you'll have to go online to look at this, is ThoroSeal, ThoroSeal. Ken, do you remember what company makes ThoroSeal?
I thought Thorough is the name.
I think it is. I think it's Thorough Products. Or something.
It's a very, very good product.
It's a silicate-based paint. Yeah. I like silicate-based paints because they will not mold. It's used as a reservoir liner, so it keeps water out. I don't know whether it keeps vapor out, but it's a nice paint. It comes in a powder. So you can mix it as as much as you want to use. You usually use a bonding agent with it, like Acryl 60 or Elmer's Block Bonder. I would suggest maybe stopping at your local brickyard. And in La Crosse, you should have a couple of good ones there. Tell them that you want to vapor seal these CMU from the interior and see what they're going to suggest.
I'm sorry, Gordy. Go ahead.
Just curious, is there anything that can be done then on the outside? I mean, if we're going to attack this on the inside first to stop that moisture penetrating through, I mean, the outside looks kind of rough from this deterioration wondering what a person would do.
Well, I can give you a couple of ideas on that. I mean, one can simply patch it, and the patches are going to hold better if they don't have the moisture pushing it. But the problem is we still have moisture that's going to be working backward into this block from the exterior. So we're going to stop the interior moisture. We're not going to stop the exterior. Then we get the freeze-thaw cycle. So how about maybe digging around the house maybe 2 foot down and putting in an exterior foundation insulation, running that a little ways up out of the ground, and then capping it over. That can have a cementous finish or even an exterior insulation finish system put over the top of it so it looks decent. You might have to do a little thinking about how you terminate it on the existing exterior walls. Now, the rest of the exterior is all still CMU, isn't it? Concrete masonry unit?
Yes.
So it's a concrete block house.
Yes.
I mean, one thing you can take a look at, if you can get a good contractor who actually knows how to do it, is basically applying sheet foam against these exterior walls and applying an exterior insulation finish system. But again, as we said with roofers, there's a tremendously high failure rate with the EIFS systems, and you need to get somebody who really knows what they're doing to seal it. But this would change the appearance of your house. It might modernize it. There are Murlex and other companies have permanent colors, so you never have to paint it. And it would improve your insulation value on the house at the same time. So it's not going to be terribly cheap, but it might be worth looking at.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
All right. So very much appreciate your help. So we'll just check with the local block dealer here and see if we can get started with sealants for the inside and then explore the contractors from there, I guess.
All right. Good. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. We have Mike from Heartland. We have a hollow spot under a basement floor on the corner of a house, and with an outside door from the basement to a walk-in garden area. A concrete contractor drilled a hole in the floor outside of the door where the floor is cracked and it's hollow underneath. So it is hollow. He suggested cutting the floor out around the crack and then fill it with stone and pour new concrete. Other contractors suggested mud jacking.
Well, mud jacking is used often and used very successfully. And what that is you drill a hole about, usually it's about an inch in, or 2 inches in diameter, and you pump this sandy, mucky product into it, and that you can adjust the height of it. That would be a really good step, could last you many, many years. I would check to see how hollow it is and what's underneath, because if there's organic matter underneath, if they just poured it on, say, topsoil, then that's only going to be a temporary fix. But if it's on inorganic matter and it's been there a while, you should be just fine.
There we go. Talking today with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. Ken of Adams Design and Construction in Madison. John of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg. They'll be with us right up till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking home renovation and repair today with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison and John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. So they come by every couple months to talk with us. Great to have them here. And thank you for listening in. We had lots of callers and lots of questions. And I'm going to go to Gene in Oshkosh first. Gene, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Your guests, these guests, have always been articulate and knowledgeable. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
The magic word for me is radon. Mm-hmm. A couple of my neighbors have had some tests, and basically, what is it? How is it ingested into the house, if that is the case? How dangerous is it? Can homes be sold with, quote, high radon levels? And where does the state stand as far as measuring, analyzing, and controlling the sale of property with radon?
Mm-hmm.
I'll take it off the earth.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. John Freiberger, we'll turn to you.
Well, Gene has just asked a question we could spend an entire hour and a half couldn't we? Because it is a complicated, and it's an important question.
Yeah.
Radon basically is a radioactive gas that that is in the soil due to breakdown of various radioactive elements in the soil. In some soil, it has easy pathways, like through sand or gravelly soil or through fractured stone. When you get into heavy clay soils, it may have no path, but it is constantly moving up out of the ground through the more easily passable soils, and it can certainly come into your basement. The federal government, in the EPA, and Gene, you can go to the EPA website and look at it, but they have set a level of 4 picocuries per cubic deciliter, which is basically a measure of how much radon is in a cubic deciliter of air when you run an air test. Beyond 4, you have a danger of lung cancer primarily. And the EPA website, if you've got radon level of X, it's like smoking so many cigarettes a day, et cetera, et cetera. But it does indeed affect human health and needs to be taken seriously. The problem with it is it changes almost every day. So we've had houses where on one day of the week it was a 2 and another day of the week it was an 11. And neither the same house. Neither of those readings were statistically significant. What we tell people to do, and Gene, if you want to test your house, what I would do is I'd get an alpha tracker kit, and I would put it in from midsummer to midwinter or midwinter to midsummer. And I'm only going to spend 30 seconds on this because I could go on for hours.
Mm-hmm.
But things like whether the laundry is in the basement and you're doing the wash and the water heater is going on, and it's winter and the furnace is going on, in which case you've got basically three exhaust fans running in the winter. Well, the day you're doing the wash and it's really cold, the radon level may be very low. In May, when nothing is going on, the air conditioning's not on, the heat isn't on, the level may be very high. And this is why you really need to look at the cooling season, the heating season, and a season in between to take a look at it. If you have things like dirt crawl spaces in your house that do not have sealed floors, you really should get those floors sealed with at least a 6 mil poly that is well secured to the walls. If you have lots of cracks in your basement floor, you really need to seal them. Try to find out, Gene, what other people in your neighborhood have gotten with legitimate tests. Do not spend $250 for a 24-hour test because it basically gives you no reliable information at all. And then think about a 6-month test.
Okay. And if what about the sale of a home then? If he was asking, what if I've got a high radon levels after I do a 6-month test?
If you do a 6-month test and have high levels, you really need to get remediation done. And there are firms that do this.
It's not that difficult to do remediation.
Some houses it's easy and some it's more difficult. Mm-hmm. If you have a newer house that has perforated drain tile around it and a sump pit, that often is where the radon is coming in. Mm-hmm. So by sealing the sump pit, putting a low motion fan and venting it outside, you take your sump pit, your water collection system, you make it into a radon collection system.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, you're trying to figure out where to drill holes in floors to draw air from underneath the slab, and that becomes a little bit more difficult. So it's one of these things where each house is different and each day is a little bit different. And you may have a house that has almost no radon at all, and then you put an energy-efficient furnace with its own outside air and a side-vented water heater, and you move the laundry to the second floor, and all of a sudden your radon in your basement triples because you've changed the number of air changes. So there are many, many things to consider. Unfortunately, we often get very simple-minded, well, we're going to do a 24-hour test and we're going to base everything upon that. But if you do have, if you're buying a house, what I tell people is if you call me and say, should I test? And I look at your house and I say, Ken, you've got a dirt crawl space, you're in sandy soil, and you've got a sump pit and perforated drain pipe, go ahead and do a test.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be accurate, but it's going to come back high, and then you can go to the seller. That's somewhat unfair, but at least with a number of houses that we've tested over the last 20 years and looked at, we can give you a pretty good idea of what to expect as far as radon.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has become sort of standard part of building inspection, though it worries me that some inspectors are maybe overselling a little bit. And at least in one case, this has resulted in a lawsuit.
Mm. There you go. Good answer. Thanks, John, for that answer. We have an email from Chris. I have a seasonal home in Door County with a partial basement. A bedroom with hardwood flooring is over a crawl space, and I'd like to insulate the floor to make it more comfy. How can I best go about that? Ken, you want to take a shot at that?
Oh, sure. I'm assuming the crawl space is probably dirt floor. It would be my guess. So the first thing you'd want to do is to cover that dirt floor up with some 6 mil plastic and seal it around the perimeter if you can. You could usually caulk it, and if there's wooden or foundation, you can caulk it to the foundation. If it's wood, you could caulk it and tack it in. And then I would say the thing that you want to do is try to insulate the walls as much as you possibly can. If you can insulate the outside of the walls, that's great. That's the best way to do it. Insulate down as far as you can dig, and making sure that where the top of the insulation meets the siding, you've got good flashing there so moisture can't get behind the insulation and run down the inside of the wall. Excuse me. If you can't do that, then the next best thing is to insulate the inside of the walls. We were talking about this on break, something that John and I both run into are people that insulate the floor, which is okay. But a lot of times they'll have plumbing running on the outside, and so their plumbing happens to be in a cold space, and you might have a water line running to, a hose bib outside that is exposed, and you don't want that to happen. So that would be the best bet, is insulate the walls. On the outside would be number one, on the inside number two. Make sure the floor is sealed so that moisture and radon can't get it through the floor into the space.
There we go. Let's go to Dave in West Bend next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a, my issue is I've got a two-car garage, about a 24 by 24, and the garage is about 60 years old, and when I bought the property, there it was cracked. The slab is cracked. About a third of the slab is cracked, and it goes the whole length of the garage, and it's causing the garage to be a bit of a leaner because it has went down, and I'm curious about the best way to fix that.
Well, it's 60 years old. That's I take it's just a slab on grade. So one thing that was talked about earlier is if you can, you can get a good mud jacking company in there and jack that that floor up so that it's close to level as possible. And then you'll have to look at the structure of the building to see if it needs some work. Quite often, I've seen the buildings start to lean, and once they start to lean, you can jack them over with those cable. I forget what they're called right now.
Like a come along.
Come along, yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Yeah.
And then put on angle braces, and that'll hold it in place. If you can't fix it by mud jacking, there's a couple other possibilities. If it's in good shape, you can get somebody to carefully lift the building off with a crane, a cherry picker, or even a large backhoe, set it off to the side, fix the slab or replace the slab, and then put it back on. That would work. And then finally, of course, it's tearing the whole thing down and starting over.
Okay. And as you say, probably the mud jacking would be the easiest or cheapest thing to
that would be the least,
that works.
Yeah, that's right. It would be the least expensive way to go. And so get a couple of estimates from qualified mud jackers. They'll tell you right away whether it's a reasonable thing to do. They don't want to have to come back in a year or two because it's failed, so they're going to want to do the best job they can.
Now, if you can mud jack something like that, you know, like I say, with that the part that's cracked, is there a way to tie that cracked part to the other side? You know, kind of like with some type of bones or something you can put in there.
Oh, you mean some sort of a pinning system?
Yeah.
Well, you could do that. You'd have to cut down into it and then pour either a cementitious or an epoxy. You can basically put epoxy pins in, pins in that are epoxied to the two sides, and that will help. It's a good chance your mud jacker can steer you in the right direction there, too.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for the heads up.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. We were talking about PlayGuard earlier, and Scott emailed in to say the website for PlayGuard is PlayGuardSurfacing.com. We were saying PlayGuard.com, but it's actually PlayGuardSurfacing.com. So I wanted to mention that. And then we had an email from Joan, who said, we have a linen closet about 3 feet wide, 4 feet tall, and 2 feet deep. Stored some distilled water on the wood floor of the closet, and the bottles leaked. We didn't discover it until some mold formed. About half of the wood floor is blackened from the mold. Do you have a recommendation for how we can either take care of the problem ourselves, or do we need a person or a firm in there to hired to take care of it? How much would you expect this to cost? And, John, what do you think?
Well, if it turned black, most likely it's an oak floor. As the water got in, the tannic acids reacted and turned black. And you're the only thing you can do there is really to have somebody, a good professional, come in and sand it. And unfortunately, it's $100 to drive the truck over and ring the doorbell. Mm-hmm. So this little closet may be almost half as expensive as doing an entire bedroom. But I think that's about all you can do. You could, if it's with a small linen closet, is take a small hand sander, work on it a little bit yourself. The problem with most people when they sand their own floors is they make a mess of it. But then again, this is in a linen closet.
Yeah.
So maybe you can do it acceptably yourself, but it really depends upon your skill level.
If you are going to sand it, though, make sure you wear dust protection so that you're not breathing in any potential molds or any finishes on this floor. Depending on how old it is, it could be some pretty yucky stuff.
Well, and the other possibility, Ken, if it's really old varnish, the old varnish can have lead in it too, can't it?
Well, that makes it.
So, yeah, anytime you do anything, wear a dust mask, whether you're sanding drywall or
we're wearing them right now.
We are.
Oh, man. We had an email from Amy. Our driveway needs to be replaced. That's happening on Summers Avenue, where we're going to be living. And we're wondering if it's possible to replace the concrete in the garage at the same time. There appears to be a small gap between the garage slab floor and the foundation of the garage.
Yeah, great. Unlike our previous caller, it sounds like this isn't a slab on grade. This garage actually has a structural frost wall. And so you should be able to then take the entire interior of the garage out and replace it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to Denise in Lamira next. Hi, Denise. Denise, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Sorry about that. I'm in the middle of a project as we speak.
Oh, okay. What can we do for you?
We have our house is about 120 years old with the stone foundation. It's about 3 feet thick. And about 3 years ago, we dug it out around it and tarred it.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, it's not wet, but it's still very moist, and we have to run a dehumidifier. Did we do the wrong thing? Because I know you're not supposed to paint the inside, because it was painted when we moved in, and we took all the paint off the rock.
Hmm. Well, you didn't. I don't think you did any harm, Denise, but you didn't do any good either. So it was, maybe you lost 4 pounds.
Okay.
We'll hope you didn't hurt your back. No. Stone foundations are simply going to transmit moisture through them. That's the nature of them.
Okay,
you
know,
unless you went all the way down to the absolute bottom of them, and then what we suggest if you really work on them, the ones we've done on historic buildings, is we've used a bentonite clay slurry on them. And that is the only thing that works, because stone foundations move a great deal. And unless you put on something very elastic, like a sheet membrane held off from the stone, or use a clay slurry applied directly to the stone, nothing really works to stop the water and moisture coming through. And the best thing to do is to have a real good quality dehumidifier, keep the basement as low as you can, and leave it at that.
All right.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Jack in Sheboygan, on to you. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to find out what is the function of house wrap. Is it like Gore-Tex for your house, where it allows vapor to pass through it but doesn't let droplets come through from the outside in?
Yeah, there's actually two purposes for it nowadays. One is to be a water barrier, and you're right, it needs to be breathable. Mm-hmm. So that humidity can work its way up. But the second thing you really want is you want a wind wrap, is you want this to be sealed so air cannot come through and bring cold in one side while pushing warm air out the other. So those are the two things that most modern house wraps do. There certainly are differences between them. You can look at Tyvek, though I really use only the commercial type. You can take a look at Henry. Ken, what are some of the other good brands that you use when you're wrapping a house?
I'll tell you, I use the commercial Tyvek, and I use felt. Those are the two wraps that I like to use.
Well, that's a real good point, Ken. Often what we do is we will wrap a house, say, with Henry or Tyvek, and then we'll put a layer of felt around it as a sacrificial layer. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about it is it mediates moisture. It protects the house wrap. The other thing to be sure to do is to download the installation instructions, because, 80% of the contractors don't know how to do it correctly?
There's a lot of ways to make mistakes.
Yes. And they're also what's the group in Minnesota that has that great booklet, Ken, on how to apply house wrap and water barrier? I bought 20 copies of it. I know I gave you one, but I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of it, but Tyvek's website's got great installation information.
Yeah.
The big one is around windows and doors, around any opening, you want to make sure that you're
close those penetrations.
And another thing to be concerned with is if you're going to put your siding right up next to it, if it's, some people have put it right over the top of foam and then put vinyl siding right over the top of it, and it kind of cooks it. And I've seen these house wraps fail in a decade because they're overheated. So which I haven't seen with felt. So I mean, felt, even though it's black and it absorbs heat, it doesn't seem to have that that short life.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help at all?
Yeah. Does that help you, Jack?
Yes, but I wanted to ask a follow-up question. If I'm going to be redoing the walls from the inside, and what I found was the house wrap or lack of under the blue board, under the vinyl siding, I was wondering, could I cut the house wrap into strips and staple it into the cavity and then re-insulate and start over?
Don't bother.
No, if you've stripped out the inside of the house, Jack, what I'd suggest you do is take a look at a spray foam insulation. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about a spray foam insulation sprayed from the interior is it's going to give you the thermal protection up to 6.2 per inch. It is going to give you the air barrier as long as it's put on correctly. And again, it's got to be done correctly. It's got to be what's called picture framed. And the third thing is it's going to give you a vapor barrier as well. So spray foam, it is expensive, but it does three things for you at once. The other thing you may want to think of, the ideal situation would be to spray foam between the studs and then put a half inch or an inch of foam over the framing before you put your drywall or plasterboard back on. This gets rid of the thermal bridging and is going to give you a wall that is going to exceed the current energy standards for Wisconsin.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Nancy in Madison, hi to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 60-year-old home, and we had hail damage a few years ago. It's a Cape Cod, and we had the upstairs siding taken off. They put the foam on, the pink foam, and they put the wrap on it and put the vinyl siding on. And now in the upstairs of the house, we have an odor in the summer only. Can that be coming from what they did?
What does it smell like? Do you know?
It's almost a yeasty smell.
Hmm.
And it's the hotter it gets, the more humid it gets, the more it smells. And in the winter, you get none of it.
Yeah, that's a stumper.
Boy, that's a tough one, Nancy. It sounds like there's some sort of issue. I would think that any chemical constituents, any volatiles, would already have been baked out of the material, unless there was some material that was just incredibly, you know, improperly constructed. But that's highly unlikely. I'm a little concerned that perhaps Cape Cods are really monsters as far as getting them insulated and vented correctly.
Yeah, they're not, almost never vented well.
Go to that Cora Vent site because they actually have drawings of Cape Cod, cora-a-vent.com. Take a look at that.
Okay.
It's possible that what you have is that you're getting high humidity buildups, and you could be right. It could be a yeast or a fungus that is growing in there. And then in the summer, when it dries out, things will offspore as they dry out, so you can get the smell in the summer. Take a look for any signs of moisture. Now, again, here, a energy analysis on the house may help, because if things are getting wet, you're going to see a lot of loss of heat through the damp area because the insulation is going to lose its resistance.
Have a company come out and look at the insulation and said that there was nothing they would do different.
Yeah. Well,
it depends on the company.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the 80% rule seems to rule in construction nowadays.
You might want to get somebody else as well to take a look at it.
And John's right. An Energy Star audit would be especially if you could do it sooner before it really gets a chance to dry out.
Yeah.
We still have a little bit of residual from the winter. So
yeah, right. There you go.
Otherwise, wait till the dead of next winter and do it again.
Thank you very much for calling in, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. And we'll see you in a couple months to do this again.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Very good. Look forward to it.
Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates Fitchburg, our guests. And they'll be back, and we will talk with them again. Tomorrow, Garden Talk, a retired senior lecturer in horticulture, Bob Tomish, joins us. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.